The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello, and welcome to the Short Circuit Live podcast. We are recording from the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. With me today are three amazing litigators. They all know each other, and you all know them. Lisa Blatt is the chair of Williams and Connolly Supreme Court and Appellate Practice. She is a legendary Supreme Court litigator with 42 arguments before the court. Lisa won in 37 of these cases. As an example of one such victory, Lisa successfully represented adoptive parents in a landmark case, Adoptive Couple versus Baby Girl, resulting in Baby Girl being happily reunited with her adoptive parents. Kelsey and Paul, our two other panelists, were also involved in the case. They supported Lisa's position as lawyers for guardian ad litem, with Paul also arguing that case before the Supreme Court. In addition to Lisa's Supreme Court practice, she also frequently litigates before the DC Circuit, including in one of the cases that we will discuss today. Lisa clerked for the legendary Ruth Bader Ginsburg during the 1989 term when RBG was a DC Circuit judge. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank
you. Kelsey Brown Corcoran is Supreme Court Director at Georgetown's Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection and Senior Lecturer at Georgetown University Law Center. Just last term, Kelsey secured two important individual rights victories before the Supreme Court in Taylor versus Riojas, involving unconstitutional prison conditions, and Torres versus Madrid, a landmark Fourth Amendment case. Kelsey clerked for Judge Tatel on the DC Circuit, who succeeded Ruth Bader Ginsburg after she became a Supreme Court Justice. Kelsey then clerked for RBG on the United States Supreme Court. Hi, Kelsey. Paul Clement is a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Kirkland & Ellis. Paul served as the 43rd Solicitor General of the United States from June 2005 until June 2008. He litigated over 100 cases before the Supreme Court, including just this term, an important Second Amendment case, New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin. Following law school, we can talk about whether NYU has a real campus.
I was just there. It still doesn't.
Following law school, Paul clerked for Judge Lawrence Silberman of the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit and for Justice Antonin Scalia on the United States Supreme Court. Welcome, Paul. I want to ask all of you about your experience clerking in the D.C. Circuit, but first, let's just give our audience, listeners in the audience here as well as at home, a taste of this circuit's history, as articulated in two very reputable sources, Chief Justice Roberts' article about the circuit that he wrote in 2006, and Justice Ginsburg's article that she co-authored in 2002. So basically, the D.C. Circuit has generally been on its own track. For example, it was a part of the Second Judiciary Act of 1801, and partially that was a reason why it was spared from the Jeffersonian backlash against John Adams's Midnight Judges. If you remember, right before John Adams and the Federalists gave up power, they created new circuit courts and appointed sympathetic judges. The Jeffersonians promptly repealed the act and abolished the judgeships. But the D.C. Circuit survived, since it was not part of that act. Next, during the Civil War, the D.C. Circuit issued a couple of habeas corpus rulings challenging the Union Army's practice of enlisting underage soldiers without the consent of their parents. As a result, President Lincoln and the Republican Congress abolished the court and terminated the judgeships. They then created a whole new D.C. Circuit and appointed four Republican judges. Another interesting fact that puts the D.C. Circuit in a league of its own is that the D.C. Circuit retained local jurisdiction until 1970, when Congress finally established a local court system for the District of Columbia. That mixed jurisdiction got it in trouble in 1933, when the Comptroller General applied the federal employee pay cut to the D.C. Circuit judges. The judges sued, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court. In the decision, O'Donohue versus United States, the Supreme Court announced that DC circuit judges were Article III judges and therefore are different from federal employees. But three justices dissented from O'Donohue, including Justice Cardozo and Chief Justice Hughes, saying that DC circuit was established under Congress's Article I authority to provide for the governance of the District of Columbia, and thus did not have Article III protection. So in 1948, Congress explicitly designated the District of Columbia one of then 11 judicial circuit courts of the United States. So it went from a very precarious situation in 1933 to becoming the second most powerful court in the nation. Roughly a third of cases it hears has to do with administrative appeals. Even if there is no exclusive jurisdiction, parties often prefer going there because of judges' advanced expertise in this matter. In addition, roughly a quarter of cases it hears deals with other issues involving the separation of powers and the reach of the federal government. The DC Circuit has always been here during the inflection points of our history. It issued decisions involving the Watergate, the Pentagon Papers, and the Vietnam War protests. It also issued decisions involving the Iran-Contra affair during the Reagan administration and the investigations centered on the Clinton administration. Most recently, it issued decisions involving the Trump administration, including the one we will be discussing today. But enough of me talking. Let's put our panelists on the spot. Lisa, let me begin with you. What was it like to clerk in the DC Circuit and for RBG?
Well, it was wonderful. I think I wanted to clerk on the DC Circuit because someone who you probably don't know of was Skelly Wright, who was a famous DC Circuit judge, and Patricia Wald and Abner Mikva. I applied to, I think, all of the judges and got an interview on the spot with Judge Ginsburg because Chris Landau had just turned her down to clerk for, I think it was Ken Starr, who then became Solicitor General. So it was a wonderful experience. I think I had a very strange and different relationship with the then judge and later Justice Ginsburg than most people. That wasn't centered at all on the law. It was centered on fashion and children and gossip. So, but one of the most memorable, I guess, experiences, other than the fact that she introduced me to alcohol, was, her relationship with Judge Silberman and then Justice Scalia by then. Those were her two best friends, and when we organized her reunion, I guess it was maybe for her 10th year on the DC Circuit, those were the two judge and justices she invited, and she was just incredibly close to them. I'm sure she thought they were nuts, which they were, but she loved them, and it had such a lasting impression on me that conservatives also deserve to be loved. But she was great. She was, I wouldn't say she used her clerks that much. By then, she was a very experienced judge. And I'm not sure, like I said, I had a very strange relationship with her. I didn't understand FERC. This was way over my head. And I don't think my first opinion I gave her, she cut out the caption and then pasted it to the opinion. So, I mean, fortunately, I have a great sense of humor that didn't even bother me. So, I loved it. I loved the year. I loved getting to know the other clerks, the other judges. I remember meeting an attorney called Merrick Garland because he had just quit his law firm job to get experience. I met then Judge Thomas that year because he had just become a judge and could not have been more friendly. And so it was amazing. And then Judge Ginsburg married me maybe a couple years later.
That's amazing.
And I'll add, because Lisa can't say this, the justice was so incredibly proud of Lisa. I always get teary when I talk about her still. Maybe that'll...
because I'm her black sheep.
No, because there's so few women still who argue before the Supreme Court. I mean, you know, so that was her former clerk who was the woman who had argued the most cases and was such a powerhouse. Anytime any of her former clerks argued before her, she would kind of give you a little smile and you knew that she was really proud, but particularly Lisa was carrying on her legacy.
When Patricia Millette became a judge, she said to me that the court lost one of their two tigers. With me being the other one. So I thought that was cute.
Yes, I remember when Barack Obama nominated Judge Millette, he said, you know, she, until recently, was the woman with most Supreme Court arguments.
I'm not sure that's right, but maybe.
But
we'll go there.
But I think he kind of had you in mind when he said that. Well, let's talk about Judge Tatel then, Kelsey, because Judge Tatel was nominated for Justice Ginsburg's seat when she went up to the Supreme Court. So tell us about your experience clerking for him.
Yeah, so I should first say you left out a really important part of my bio, which is that I worked for Paul twice.
Well, that's baby girl thing,
That was true, right, but so I think you were my boss's boss at the Justice Department when you were Solicitor General and I was in civil appellate. And then I went to work at Bancroft, which was Paul's boutique firm before it folded into Kirkland. I was there 15 months and got to do incredible work with Paul. And I left not because he fired me, but because I started my clerkship with Justice Ginsburg. So, and I also want to say I love the Short Circuit newsletter. I look forward to it. One thing that wasn't mentioned earlier is it makes me laugh out loud at least once each time I read it. And you totally got me with the April Fool's case last week. So I clicked on it and I was like, what? Had to do with an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Anyways, okay. So
shout out to John Ross.
Yeah. I would love to, you know, just talk a little bit about Judge Tatel's legacy. He's going senior, taking senior status this year after 28 years of public service. As you said, he was nominated to take Justice Ginsburg's seat when she was elevated. They remained close friends for decades after that. So I think. The most important part of his legacy will be his profound jurisprudential contributions, particularly complex constitutional and administrative law questions, even more particularly environmental law. So the year that I was clerking, he wrote his dissent in Massachusetts v. EPA, which is, you know, we're now 16, 17 years ago. This is an incredibly important case involving greenhouse gas emissions, and Massachusetts was suing the EPA in an attempt to get them to regulate, and so there was the question of whether the state had standing to do that, and also whether the EPA, the extent of its authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. And so the D.C. Circuit denied the state's petition with a dissent by Judge Tatel. The case went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court reversed in a decision that largely tracked Judge Tatel's dissent. And so not all of his opinions end with a victory like that. He wrote the majority opinion in Shelby County v. Holder, which was reversed by the Supreme Court, but his opinion there was the basis for Justice Ginsburg's dissent in that case, which was ultimately what earned her the moniker Notorious RBG and kind of catapulted her into worldwide fame, but that's a different story, and there are, like, movies about it that you can watch. So there's all of that extraordinary work he's done, and then I think he's just such a stalwart of engendering public confidence in the court and kind of just maintaining and preserving its integrity. He is so well-respected on both sides of the aisle, both by jurists. He also shared close friendships with Judge Silberman and other of Republican-appointed judges on the court, and also with attorneys and litigants, just because he takes his job so, so seriously. Every case is extraordinarily important to him because it's extraordinarily important to the parties. They have a lot at stake. Every single case, you know, clerking for him, you would see that he would read every word of the briefs with an open mind, thoughtfully considering all of the arguments. He always comes to oral argument prepared to ask really thoughtful questions. And then just his perfectionism in his opinion writing is a reflection of how seriously he takes public service. So that was one of, I mean, probably the seminal writing experience I had was, you know, like a lot of the judges, the clerks would write the first draft of the opinion, and then you would give it to the judge, and he would totally rewrite it, as Lisa said. But then what he would do, and I think probably he still does this with his clerks, we would sit together for hours going over each sentence of the opinion and why he had changed it and what he was doing in that opinion. Every sentence was extremely important to him. And so I learned kind of both substantively what was important, organizationally, you know, how to kind of present the arguments in a linear fashion. And then even there has never been a human being in the like history of the world who is more committed to using as few words as possible to express his ideas. I mean, you will not find an extraneous word in any of his opinions. I remember sitting with him one time, and he made a word plural so that he could take out the A so that the sentence would be one letter shorter. And that sticks with me. 17 years later, when I'm writing, I'm fixating over every sentence, and I'm making words plural and obsessing over whether it needs a that or not. You know. And so it was such a gift. And Justice Ginsburg did that as well. She would sit with you. Just such an education. I think I learned more in those hours sitting with him than I did in law school about legal writing. So I'm incredibly grateful. It was such a gift to me to get to spend that time with him. And then I think just he's been a gift to the country. So, yeah, I'll stop there.
It's really amazing. I thought we only did that when we had to get under word counts. Yeah. I didn't realize people actually did that when they were subject to no word count.
Paul, why don't you tell us about Judge Silberman?
I will, but let me talk first just a little bit about how I ended up applying to the D.C. Circuit, because I think it actually speaks volumes about what makes the D.C. Circuit different. Unlike Lisa, I did not decide I wanted to apply to the D.C. Circuit because it was Judge Bezalan's court or Skelly Wright's court, or really for any particularly noble reason. And when I was a second-year law student and thinking about applying for clerkships, some of the 3Ls told me you really should apply to the D.C. Circuit. And I started doing some research about the D.C. Circuit's docket and its ad law cases and its FERC cases. And I started to think these 3Ls were playing a trick on me. because it actually didn't, at first blush, seem like the most interesting set of cases that you could have. And compared to other circuits where you tend to have everything from diversity cases that are coming up through the system and presenting interesting issues of kind of state law, and on top of that, constitutional issues that are the kind of constitutional issues that can arise everywhere but typically would apply in terms of states' rights or other issues that just don't arise in the D.C. Circuit, and then capital cases, no capital cases in the D.C. Circuit. So the D.C. Circuit docket, it's just very different from the other circuits. And even as I started interviewing with some of the judges, I was a little skeptical about this whole D.C. Circuit thing. And then I interviewed with Judge Silberman, and I was sold. I think I was also given an exploding offer, so I didn't have a lot of choice in the matter. But I was really blown away by the experience of interviewing with Judge Silberman. And what made Judge Silberman so wonderful to clerk for is he was a tremendous jurist. I think he would rival Judge Tatel for trying to be economical with his words. But he also had this amazing career even before he got to the judiciary that made him just one of the most interesting people you could ever talk to. This person was deputy attorney general when he was 34 years old. So he just had this incredible career. He had told off Marshal Tito in Yugoslavia when he was the ambassador of the United States to Yugoslavia. I mean, Yugoslavia doesn't even exist anymore, right? I mean, this man's career has just spanned decades and amazing public service, but amazing stories. And he was not unwilling to share those stories with his law clerks over lunches, and it was just an amazing year. One thing that really made it distinct is it was an entirely oral clerkship. There were no bench memos. Those were things that people in other chambers had to do. But we had no bench memos. Everything was presented to the judge orally. You sort of talk through the cases, argued about the cases. Sometimes we'd walk out of his chambers and his secretary was looking at us, was like, is everything okay? I mean, the voices were raised, but we really, it was such a wonderful experience with him in just exchanging ideas and talking through issues and the rest. So it's something that I think was just such a formative experience. And clerking for Justice Scalia, they were very good friends, and the clerkship was also a pretty oral clerkship. So those combinations, I think, of clerkships was really extraordinary. The one other thing I just wanted to say about the D.C. Circuit that makes it different, particularly from the clerk's perspective, is all the clerks are in one building. It's not like the typical regional circuit where maybe there's two other chambers in your building and then some of the law clerks for the other judges you might see episodically at a sitting or something, but otherwise you don't really get to know them. So you really got to know the law clerks for the other judges. You got to know the other judges to a degree that I think is pretty unusual. We played basketball together. We played softball together, sometimes with the district court clerks. A little bit of poker, that's right.
And you say district court clerks because district court also...
They're all in the same building.
As well as the FISA court, right?
They didn't tell us there was a FISA court back then. But the district court, you know, a lot of the district court clerks were people we went to law school with, so we already knew. Deanne Maynard, who's a friend of ours, was on the district court that year. We played softball together all of the time. So that sort of experience as a law clerk, I think, is very different from a typical law clerk to a regional circuit judge. And I think it really makes the clerkship a special experience. Now, when I later found out that Fifth Circuit clerks got to go to New Orleans on a per diem, I was a little jealous about that. But otherwise, I think a D.C. Circuit clerkship just can't be beat.
And another interesting thing about the D.C. Circuit is that you don't have the blue chip rule, right, where a senator from the state gets to kind of have a say about who to nominate from their state. And in D.C. Circuit, you actually, you know, had judges from North Carolina, South Carolina, Colorado. So you have kind of a greater geographical diversity, as well as a diversity of experiences.
I think that's very true. And I think sometimes the lack of a blue slip has affected who ends up on the D.C. Circuit. I think in some examples, you have a judge who ran into a blue slip problem in his or her home state, and all of a sudden the D.C. Circuit becomes an attractive option. And then you also have the ability to appoint some people like really all three of the judges we clerked for who were really sort of D.C. people. You know, I think it would have been hard. Judge Silberman started his legal career in Hawaii, but I don't think... At the point that he was nominated to the D.C. Circuit, that he still had a lot of home state connections to Hawaii or New Jersey or where he grew up or anything like that. So I think it really does, it gives you that unique sort of membership of the court.
Yeah, fascinating place. With that in mind then, let's start talking about the cases. After all, this is a short circuit podcast where we discuss circuit court opinions. Let's start with you, Paul, and this fascinating case, Trump versus Thompson. Could you introduce the case, Paul?
I'll introduce the case, and I will start introducing it by just sort of as a transition to what I was saying about the D.C. Circuit and its unique makeup of cases. So I don't know that any law clerk or any judge comes to the D.C. Circuit just to do the FERC cases. And some of the cases are not super exciting, but there are other cases that could only arise in the D.C. Circuit. And they are some of the most important separation of powers cases that any court is dealing with. Many of these cases end up going to the Supreme Court afterwards. And I think that's one of the things that makes the D.C. Circuit so special and unique. And one of the reasons I wanted to talk about the Trump v. Thompson case is because this is a case only in D.C. Only in the D.C. Circuit would you have a case like this. So the case in a nutshell arises out of events that everybody is familiar with, starting with January 6th and then the appointment of the Congressional Committee to investigate January 6th. The committee has asked for lots and lots of documents from various sources, including many of the documents that were generated in the Oval Office on January 6th. Now, where are those documents right now? most of them anyways, are in the archives. And so when, and they're transferred there as under the Presidential Records Act. And so as a matter of form, what you have is a request from Congress to the archives for these documents. But when they ask for presidential records, which these clearly are, core presidential records, because they're records from the Oval Office on January 6th, it triggers a process where the sitting president gets involved, and potentially in a situation like this, the former president gets involved as well. And what happened in the case of these documents is the archives received the request, asked the current White House for their view on whether they were wanted to assert executive privilege. The current White House counsel sent a letter saying that the White House, the president, doesn't want to assert executive privilege over the documents. Not that they're not subject to executive privilege, but that based on the extraordinary situation, the current president's view of the extraordinary need for the documents, that they would not assert privilege. That prompted, under a statutory process, the notification of the former president. The former president, shockingly, had a different view and thought that that executive privilege should be invoked on the documents, and ultimately sued in the District of Columbia District Court to essentially enjoin the archives from transferring the documents over to the Congressional Committee, lost in the district court, came up to the D.C. Circuit before a panel of Judge Millett, who we mentioned earlier, Judge Wilkins, and this newly elevated judge to the D.C. Circuit who had barely heard any appellate cases, Judge Jackson, soon to be Justice Jackson, was also on this panel. And they issued their decision, essentially affirming the district court and siding against former President Trump. I think it's probably fair to say this is the most consequential decision that Judge Jackson sat on as a D.C. Circuit judge. And the opinion for the D.C. Circuit is roughly 67 pages long. It covers the waterfront. It's another one of these opinions. It's hard to imagine this opinion being written by Judge Tatel, since 67 pages might have been a little too long, but also hard to imagine this opinion being written in a different circuit just because of the nature of all of the material it covers. There's an extensive discussion of OLC opinions and even Senate testimony by OLC deputies. And there's a sophistication with the D.C. Circuit judges when they're dealing with these separation of powers cases that you're really only going to get if you routinely have these cases as an important part of your docket. And it's all reflected in this opinion. The opinion focuses a lot. If I were just going to describe it to you in a sentence or two, I would say the D.C. Circuit opinion really focused on the fact that both the current president and the Congress had made a judgment that they really wanted these documents, and the joint judgment of both political branches really made it a pretty straightforward case that the former president wasn't going to be able to sustain his claim of privilege, that the need, as verified by the political branches, overwhelmed his claim to privilege. A funny thing then happened, which is the former president's lawyers filed an application to stay the D.C. Circuit decision, stay the mandate pending cert, and the Supreme Court issued what I guess you'd describe as an order. It doesn't even rise to the level of a per curiam opinion. Words per curiam, I don't think, appear on it. But what the D.C. Circuit said, or rather the Supreme Court said, in that very brief order is that we're going to deny the motion to stay the mandate, but the discussion in the D.C. Circuit opinion that focused on the status of the president and the former president here being the person invoking the privilege was dictum and shouldn't be essentially given any weight going forward. And I just want to read you the last sentence of this order. It says, any discussion of the Court of Appeals concerning President Trump's status as a former president must therefore be regarded as non-binding dictum. Now, this is a pretty wild move by the Supreme Court to basically take a 67-page D.C. Circuit opinion that's mostly about the fact that this is the former president making the assertion against the wishes of the current president and effectively dictamize it, if that's a word. So I don't know if my co-panelists have thoughts about this. Kelsey, you were involved in it a little bit.
A little bit. I thought that quote came from the Kavanaugh
That's from the actual opinion? That's the last
that's
line.
That's really interesting.
Order.
Justice Kavanaugh goes further.
Yeah.
He goes further. He does something similar. Yeah.
And says it's wrong. I mean, so he does go much further, but that's from the...
From the actual opinion. I read it when it came out. I think your description of it was exactly right. And just to pick up a little on your point about the sophistication of Judge Millett's analysis, I think you see this dynamic between the D.C. Circuit, and particularly Judge Millett and Chief Justice Roberts. You mentioned the Trump's lawyers went to get a stay from the Supreme Court. The D.C. Circuit panel entered an administrative stay until the Supreme Court ruled on the emergency application for a stay. And that was a show of courtesy in respect to the Supreme Court, because if they hadn't done that, then the Supreme Court justices would have been scrambling within hours to have to decide whether or not to grant the stay or not. And so we could see that decision coming out very differently if they couldn't have time to even read Judge Millett's 67-page opinion before entering the stay in order to keep the archivist from releasing the documents. The flip side of that is once the D.C. Circuit panel entered that administrative stay, the Supreme Court could have just sat on this a really long time, right? Like, there wasn't an expiration date on the stay that the D.C. Circuit put in place. It could have been months. They could have waited until after the midterms, right? Just leave this out, and they're not actually doing anything one way or another. That's not what happened. Within a couple of weeks, the application went first to the Chief Justice. The opinion, I guess it is, says that he referred it to the whole court. And they ruled on it. And so I think that rapport you see, it doesn't always go that way, right? Often the Supreme Court reverses what the D.C. Circuit does. But I think it's a reflection of these two very important courts in the same city with judges who all know each other, having mutual respect. So I think that all just procedurally played out exactly as it should have. And then the other piece of that is in this 60-plus page opinion by Judge Millett, she essentially goes through every single possible way that President Trump could lose, and explains, well, you lose under all of the ways. And by doing that, the panel gutted kind of the significance of the legal question, because there's a really interesting legal question here, is what authority does a former president have intervene in order to keep documents from being relieved? What's the executive privilege there? And her opinion, as you said, kind of comes down and says, well, you lose under any way. And so when you read this denial of the stay application by the Supreme Court, they say, that important question isn't presented here because you lose all of the ways. And so I think Judge Millett did the Supreme Court a favor when she wrote the opinion that thoroughly.
But I will say, the funny thing is, she did go through and march through all of the different possible tests, but really at every point in her analysis, she depended on the fact that it was 2-1, and it was the sitting president endorsing essentially the views of Congress. So that's what I find so puzzling, is because the court relied on the formal fact that she rejected the claim under every test to say that we don't really have to view this as having any holding on the status of the former president. But it was the fact that it was the former president, because if it was the sitting president, you couldn't get a 2-1, because it would be the sitting president would either not assert the privilege, in which case it'd be straightforward, or the sitting president would assert the privilege, and then it would be a one-on-one battle. So this 2-1, you're outnumbered dynamic really seemed to me to be the entire reasoning of the opinion, and now it's kind of poof, to use a technical term.
I thought it was extraordinary, and really what I thought was a tour de force. I mean, Judge Millett writes with such color and flair. I love reading her opinions. My favorite was the one where the FAA was not making the seats wide enough for passengers, and it was just the most amazing discussion of a person who has trouble fitting in their airline seat. And she just has a way to really bring a lot of life to the opinion. And that this was a glorious opinion. It's got a lot on January 6th, and I kind of threw it away after the Supreme Court said what they said. It was kind of all irrelevant.
It felt a little bit like she just wanted to kind of lay out the case also of what happened on January 6th, right? So a lot of pages right in the beginning. It's just kind of, here's what was going on.
Yeah, she told
because
the
story. Because I know people, yeah, go ahead, Lisa.
No, she just wanted to tell the story.
Yeah. The other thing I thought was interesting in the opinion is that she actually acknowledges an interesting thing that could go in the former President Trump's favor, which is they're asking for documents so soon after his presidency, right? And she kind of, during the oral arguments and then in the opinion itself, she kind of mentions it and says, you know, the parties really didn't pause on it carefully, so I'm not going to say much on this, but I do think that it could be, you know, harmful potentially to ask former presidents for documents this quickly after they leave office, because it creates bad incentive for presidents who are actually sitting in office right now, knowing that somebody will come after them once they go. And that kind of goes to just how carefully she thought through every argument for and against. With that, let's move on to our next case, Atchley versus AstraZeneca. Kelsey.
Yeah, so this case arises out of a series of attacks on Americans who were living in Iraq during the U.S. military presence there in the early 2000s. So the plaintiffs in this case are hundreds of victims of those terrorist attacks, some service members, some civilians, and then also the family members of those victims. So the terrorist attacks were undertaken by a group, gosh, I was going to ask you how to pronounce this, Lisa, before we started. Jaish al-Mahdi, did I say that right?
I don't know.
Jaish al-Mahdi. But that is not the defendant in this suit. As Anya said, it's AstraZeneca. It's a collection of medical supply and manufacturing companies, some of which have become household names because of COVID vaccines. So there's AstraZeneca, Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, yeah, are all defendants. I think there are 21 defendants total in this case. And you're now so excited to hear how these companies are involved in the terrorist attack, so I will tell you. I will say first, this case is at the pleading stage, so these are all allegations, although it is an incredibly detailed complaint, 588 pages of allegations and public sources, and it's, I guess, plaintiffs are represented by Kellogg Cuber, so they are very well represented. So the allegation here, and there's a lot of wonderful lawyers on the other side as well. The allegation is that these companies were providing medical supplies to the Iraqi Ministry of Health, which was at the time wholly controlled by this terrorist group. So they were selling medical supplies to the ministry, which was, again, the face of the terrorist group. And not only were they selling the supplies, but they were also giving cash kickbacks as bribes, and they were providing some free goods on the side that the terrorist group would then sell in the black market. And then all of this kind of money that was coming in was used to finance the terrorist attacks on the plaintiffs. So that's essentially what the allegations are. The district court dismissed the case for failure to state a claim, and it also dismissed, I think, six of the defendants, which were foreign entities, for lack of personal jurisdiction. So this goes up to the D.C. Circuit, which reverses. The panel is Judge Pillard, Judge Edwards, and Judge Wilkins, yes. And Judge Pillard wrote the opinion. It's over 60 pages, so I will, I think, just pick a couple of highlights of the holdings there. One of the arguments, the claims are under the Anti-Terrorist Act, which provides a private cause of action in tort for injuries arising from international acts of terrorism. So one of the things that the defendants have argued is that this particular terrorist group is not a designated terrorist organization in the United States and therefore doesn't trigger liability under the Anti-Terrorist Act. What the DC Circuit said was, well, they're very closely intertwined with Hezbollah, which is a designated terrorist organization, and therefore that qualifies. The other big issue was proximate causation. So the defendants have argued that the ministry was a intermediary that broke the chain of causation between the payment of the kickbacks and the actual terrorist acts. The D.C. Circuit rejects that argument, again, says these are two sides of the same coin, the ministry and the terrorist group. An interesting kind of twist there is that the plaintiffs have alleged both direct liability and secondary liability. So secondary liability probably makes sense from what I've said, right, like aiding and abetting the terrorist group. They also have a claim for direct liability, which is that what the defendants did was a act of terrorism. The district court didn't actually reach that question because it held no proximate causation. And the D.C. Circuit panel was like, we're not going to decide that either. We're sending that back to the district court in the first instance. So I think those were the, oh, and then there was this question of whether the defendants knew that the money was being used for the terrorist acts. And the Pillar, Judge Pillar's opinion essentially says there was all sorts of, it was widely publicized, it was in the news, these are sophisticated organizations that would have picked up on that. And then for personal jurisdiction, it had to do with whether these foreign defendants, whether their the claims arose out of or related to their conduct in the United States. And the D.C. Circuit said yes. So the D.C. Circuit reversed, and now there is an en banc, I think two en banc petitions pending, and the court ordered a response. And the response briefs were filed almost a month ago. So it's interesting. You know, we'll see whether they're going to ultimately grant the en banc petitions or whether they're someone's preparing a dissent from the denial en banc. We'll see.
There are interesting things like this idea of Ministry of Health, right? That these organizations, they're going to the Ministry of Health and they're making contracts with the Ministry of Health and they're providing these medical supplies to the Ministry of Health. So it's kind of, what do you guys make of this argument that the court makes that, you know, essentially, Ministry of Health is this, you know, al-Sadr organization. That seems kind of, you know, the United States government itself was also doing business with the Ministry of Health, right? But the court actually is not taking judicial notice of that and kind of is saying that even though it was Ministry of Health, we really think it was this al-Sadr organization that these companies were doing business with.
So, I mean, I think that's, you know, one of the problems when you consider this case based on the allegations. I mean, Kelsey made a point of saying at this point in the litigation, you're doing this based on the allegations. And if you take the allegation seriously that this Ministry of the Health is controlled by a terrorist group, then a lot of the rest of the analysis seems like it flows pretty directly from that. Now, that's a big allegation, heck of a thing to prove, but at the motion to dismiss stage, it is what it is. And it's one of the things that makes this case, I think, a little different from most of these cases that arise in similar contexts. But we talk about cases that could arise only in the D.C. Circuit. This is a case that could arise in other circuits because other circuits have dealt with these ATS cases, ATA cases, and what is it, JASTA is the statute that Congress passed to make it slightly easier to bring these claims. But a lot of the other claims involve banks that process transactions and the questions whether they knew they were processing them for a terrorist group or just individuals. Facebook and Twitter and Google have all been sued because, imagine that, social networking, even among terrorists. So you have most of these cases, the typical dynamic is that you just provided a service to a group, maybe almost like unwittingly. And I think that's what makes this case interesting from an allegation standpoint, if they can prove it, is the allegations sort of have the defendants kind of much closer to the actual action than in, I think, one of the typical one of these cases.
Yeah, I think that's right. And particularly, you know, if this case gets to discovery, and we'll see, right? The en banc petition's pending. I'm sure there'll be a Supreme Court cert petition after that. But it seems like the sort of case where the whole game is going to be discovery, what actually comes out. Does it turn out that the relationship is as close as the allegations suggest? Is it even closer? Who knows? So I think it remains to be seen whether that has any traction.
And the thing about these suits that are, frankly, I think hard from the defendant's perspective is nobody wakes up in the morning wanting to even be alleged to be aiding and abetting Hezbollah or some of these other terrorist organizations. So these suits, if they can get past the motion to dismiss stage, create huge settlement pressures, even if there isn't that much there in discovery. And yet, it's hard to deny that Congress has passed statutes to make it easier to bring these claims. So it is a situation. I had one of these cases for a financial institution 5 or 6 years ago, and they're hard cases because it's. I mean, obviously, no lawyer is going to make the allegations unless they feel like they can prove their case. But it's relatively easy to allege cooperation to a degree that satisfies aiding and abetting. And once you do that, boy, this is not a dynamic that any major corporation wants to be dealing with.
Although I'll say on the flip side also, this case strikes me unusual in the sense that the plaintiffs are so well-resourced and were able, through kind of pulling public documents, to provide as much detail as they did in the complaint. Most of the time when you have plaintiffs bringing, you know, I do civil rights lawsuits, to be able to pass, you know, to survive the pleading standard. Anya's nodding because she does a lot of the same work I do. To get past the pleading standard before you've had a chance to do any discovery is incredibly difficult. So I think there are hardships on both sides. And then you have a case like this where you've got so many highly paid lawyers on both sides, it starts to look very different.
Well, plainly, if you file a 500 page complaint, you've read Twombly.
Yeah. I was just going to tell IJR, so there we're always so proud of our complaints that, you know, have a lot of pages of allegations in them. This one beats that. One question I had that's kind of to the side, there is an amicus brief by members of the Senate talking about the aiding and abetting statute. I don't see that very often, and it's a bipartisan group, you know, including somebody like Sheldon Whitehouse and Marco Rubio. How much import does a court give to an amicus brief like that? They are members of the Senate, but they are not the Senate itself, right? Is it even worth, often in our cases, we think, you know, the Westfall Act, wouldn't it be nice to get an amicus brief from Chuck Grassley, you know? That's really not, you know, it's senators saying what they think now, but it's not really, you know, reading into congressional intent, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I think by well-written bipartisan amicus briefs always get attention. I'm sure, you know, all of the amicus briefs in this case were closely read. But this is also, again, as Paul was saying, the D.C. Circuit is so sophisticated, and this is a very sophisticated panel of judges. I doubt that they were that influenced by anything other than the arguments. I mean, they're fully capable of kind of processing and critically thinking about the arguments made by the parties.
Look, lots of judges say that everyone's textualists now. So if you have an amicus brief from members of Congress that tries to do post legislative history, I don't think that's not going to move the needle at all. But on the other hand, if the senators are able to sort of, first of all, just showing up and being bipartisan is going to have a certain impact. And then if the argument in the brief, as Kelsey's saying, is a persuasive argument, it will be taken into account and given respectful consideration. But I think, I almost feel like if you have one of those amicus briefs, you almost have to be careful to avoid the trap of making it seem like you're backfilling the congressional record or something, because most of the judges aren't going to pay attention to what was in the congressional record contemporaneously, and they're going to have their guard up for anything that sort of smacks of post hoc legislative history. So you do have to be careful with those briefs.
My only comment is I thought the petitions for rehearing were very well done. Very compelling.
Concise, too. We had a word count.
With that then, Lisa, let's go to you and talk about Jibril versus Mayorkas.
Yeah, so I have a fun one, but I have notes. This is Jibril versus Mayorkas. This is a decision written by, authored by Judge Edwards and signed by Judges Henderson and Walker. And this one, I think, relates more than the other cases to all of us. This is about when we fly. The FBI has a database that apparently two types. There's the no-fly list, when you are not allowed on the plane. And there's a selectee list, which basically is a terrorist watch list. And you don't know if you're on it, but you... Some people get something, which I've never seen, which suggests I'm not on this watch list, that says SSSS, which stands for Secondary Screening Security Selection. But the government won't tell you what that means, but it's on your boarding pass. So we have the Jibrils, and their story is quite moving. They're a married couple with adult children and one minor child. And the reason why I'm telling you this is because the court finds it very significant. They travel to the Middle East a lot because that's where their family is, and their religion actually requires them to regularly travel to Saudi Arabia, and that becomes important later. So in 2008, they had a nightmare trip, as you can just sort of, you could have written this. They had SSSS written on their boarding pass, and they were searched for 3 hours, I guess, before their flight took off. They were all pat down, including the minor child. They missed their flights coming home. The agents threw away all the things that they had bought from, I guess it was Jordan. They didn't offer this poor child food and separated the child from their parents. And there's this wonderful line in there saying, and the record does not reflect that anyone was asked whether they had any medication they needed to take. I mean, the judges really felt for them. So they get back and file, and this just all sounds, I'm going to use the word Kafkaesque a lot. They file a complaint in something called the Traveler Redress Inquiry Program. And the response back from the government is just classic. It's, we can neither confirm nor deny that you're on this list, but we have made any corrections that may have been necessary. It's just amazing. So they sue for the under a couple Fourth Amendment claims, a due process claim, and an Administrative Procedure Act claim. And the trial court dismissed, which I found a little bit startling, for lack of standing. So this was a resounding win for the plaintiffs. The court said, in almost slightly sarcastic, that it was reasonable to infer from what had happened to them that they were actually on this, they were on this terrorist watch list, and that they were on the SSS list and would still be on it. And then where they got really mad is saying they obviously have future travel plans and the government hasn't told them they're not on this list. And at oral argument, they said there was a suggestion that this couple or their children just try another flight and see what happens. And the court didn't like that. And the court said whether that suggestion was meant to be a tongue-in-cheek quip or simply a heartless argument, it makes no sense. The whole point was to prevent harm. So they're allowed to seek relief and say, including revisions to this traveler redress program. And why this is such a neat case is because it's this bipartisan panel, and it's really kind of man of the people, and it's just wonderful, yay for Americans. But it ends on the most Kafkaesque note imaginable. So this is, it literally says the following. We note, because selectee status constitutes sensitive national security information, revisions to the Traveler Redress Inquiry Program may not exist that would allow the Jibrils to discover whether they are or ever were on the selectee list. So I don't know what that means. I hope that one of you will enlighten me, but I can only imagine what the government and the parties are thinking. They won, but they have to go back, and they were just told, you have standing because it's redressable, but in the end, we have to point out the government's probably never going to tell you one way or the other what's going on here. So I don't know, neat opinion, but maybe if you have a SSS on your boarding pass, I would be careful. Get to the airport early.
Yeah, we had two clients in IJ cases that got in similar situation. One, Gerardo Serrano versus CBP. He was crossing the border in his truck, United States-Mexico border. And then Antonia Nwaorie versus CBP. She was a U.S. citizen who was traveling to Nigeria. And that's exactly what she got. She got this SSSS. And in both cases, we filed TRIP applications, and we got the exact same responses as the response in that the panel is discussing here, which is, you know, we can neither confirm nor deny, but we did receive.
They did say to the child, one of the family members didn't get a response, but the child's got a response that said, your experience may have been misidentification. So,
yeah, that's more.
I mean, my sense of this was a long rendition of the treatment, and it was like, if you're gonna deal with these people, they had not sued for damages. The regulations require the parent not to be separated from the child and not to be interrogated, and they just blew it at every stage. And so I think the court was a little bit miffed in saying, you know, if you're gonna be doing this, at least try to run a railroad with some sensitivity.
Yeah, and do you find the court's article, that Article 3 standing analysis persuasive? Because the government, you know, in their briefs, they kept saying, you know, the Jibrils, they have no plans, you know, for traveling in the future, so they really don't
well,
have
I mean,
that.
It was frivolous, except for the court ends with their, it might not be redressable. So I just, yes, but the notion that they didn't suffer injury in fact and aren't going to fly again was preposterous. And I remember at one point, the government said, but it didn't happen all the other times you went to Jordan. And the court sort of sarcastically says, maybe you were put on the watch list before you went on your 2018 trip. I mean, it was just, I think they had about had it with bad arguments that day in court.
Yeah, so I think, as Lisa said, it's notable that this the panel here, you have Judge Edwards wrote the opinion, and then Judge Henderson and Judge Walker. I think, you know, even though it's primarily a standing decision, it's also an administrative law decision in the sense that, right, this is an appeal of an agency decision. And going back to your point, Anya, about the expertise of the D.C. Circuit, I think this reflects the value of having a court that sees so many of these administrative law cases, because they get so many data points. They have a level of expertise and competence that when agencies are actually doing things that are outside the scope of their discretion, they don't hesitate to say, no, absolutely not, this is ridiculous. And to push back when the Justice Department, you know, this was defended by my old office, civil appellate, and, you know, often those cases begin with all sorts of, you know, no jurisdiction, no standing, no cause of action, right? Everything you can say before you get to the merits of the argument. And so I think the case proceeded pretty typically for an administrative law, dispute that's being litigated by the Justice Department. And so I think it's refreshing. I think also you see that the inclination or the confidence of the D.C. Circuit judges in overturning agency decisions or pushing back on agencies isn't ideological. I mean, the judges across the ideological spectrum will do that when they think it's necessary. And I agree with Lisa that this is obviously a case where it was necessary. Hopefully they're able to get some sort of relief at some point.
And I think that's a really important point, because you alluded to this. There are a number of these APA cases. As a litigant, you have the opportunity to challenge agency action either in the D.C. Circuit or in the regional court of appeals where the company's based and or the like. And the reason that a lot of people take the choice of the D.C. Circuit is precisely because of this sophistication and repeat player. Because if you were a regional court of appeals and you're not used to the civil appellate playbook, where there are six different jurisdictional doctrines before you even get to the merits, and you're not routinely hearing arguments about ripeness and exhaustion and standing and the like, it's easy to sort of lose your case on one of those thresholds. And then when you get to the merits, you know, if you take Chevron and arbitrary and capricious review seriously, or at face value maybe, that's a pretty good set of doctrines for the government. But if you're in front of judges who are seeing like a dozen FERC cases every year, and they know like, this opinion is like a D minus. Like, this is not, like, you know, this is not FERC's best work. They're going to be inclined to reverse the agency in that situation, where a regional circuit that might see one FERC case in a blue moon, I think, is going to be much more instinctively of the view that this energy regulation stuff is super complicated. And there are a bunch of cases that say we often defer, so we defer. So I do think this repeat player sophistication kind of on a bipartisan basis is a real key to why so many of these APA cases end up in the D.C. Circuit, even when the litigants have a choice of going somewhere.
Yeah, I often tell clients when I've had actually realizing all these cases now I've had in the D.C. Circuit, and I've never been able to tell a client anything about the panel. I'm just like, the panel doesn't matter. These are strictly administrative law cases. And the same was true when I was in government. I was the Medicare and Medicaid assistant for 13 years. It was all D.C. Circuit cases. And it had almost nothing to do with the panel you drew, because they were all just so administrative law-based. Just the politics didn't seem to matter.
I had a case a number of years ago in the D.C. Circuit against the government. It was a Medicaid case. And at one point in the argument, one of the judges asked the government lawyer what this accounting error that we had pointed out would cost the government. And the government lawyer's response, which I'll never forget, was, well, I'm not sure of the exact number, but it starts with a B. And that's the kind of answer that I think would have phased a lot of other judges. But the judges on the D.C. Circuit were like, okay. I mean, it's an administrative law case. If you blew it, you blew it. A lot of money in this program. So if it ends up being a $1 billion mistake, so be it. And I think that's the attitude that as a challenger you're looking for in a court when you're bringing an APA challenge.
Well, I think we came full circle from where we started, why DC Circuit has its own path and goes its own way. Thank you so very much for coming to Short Circuit Live, for doing this panel with us. It's been an honor and a pleasure.
Thank you for having us. This is great.
Yeah, this has been great.